Welcome to the First Things Podcast. On this episode, I'll talk to Charles Camosi, ethics professor at Fordham, about Charlie Gard, the British infant who died recently when his life support was withdrawn by order of the state. Opinion is divided about the ethics of Charlie's death. Even the Catholic Church has given no clear guidance. Camosi says we should call it what it was, euthanasia. Then, I'll mark the 200th anniversary of the death of Jane Austen with a reflection on her finest novel. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. On July 28th, Charlie Gard died in hospice. The son of British parents, just shy of his first birthday, he had been born with a rare genetic condition. Mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome causes deterioration of brain function, leading to seizures, muscle weakness, and organ failure. The only treatments for it are experimental. The conflict began in February. Charlie's parents wanted to take him to the U.S. for an experimental treatment, with £1.3 million raised for the purpose through crowdfunding. Doctors wanted to remove Charlie's ventilator. Litigation ensued. Charlie's parents appealed all the way to the European Court of Human Rights, which sided with the doctors and the British state. On July 24th, Charlie's parents withdrew their legal challenge, announcing that the window of opportunity for the experimental treatment had closed. They wanted to take their son home to die, but of course that request was denied too. I'm joined by Charles Camosi. Charlie is Associate Professor of Theological and Social Ethics at Fordham, and he's written extensively on the ethics of neonatal care, and on the Charlie Gard case in particular. His web essay, Learning from Charlie Gard, appeared on firstthings.com last week. So to be clear, there are two Charlies involved in this segment, our subject and my guest, be advised. So let's start with definitions. First, two terms that I think have constituted a bit of a red herring in this case, but let's first define them and then we can assess their pertinence. The terms are ordinary care and extraordinary care. Charlie Camosi, what is ordinary care and what is extraordinary care?
Well, let's start by saying what they're not. So ordinary and extraordinary does not mean, in the case of ordinary care, it happens a lot, and extraordinary care doesn't happen that often. That's not what it means. It may accidentally happen that that's the case, but that's not what they mean. Ordinary is a term of normativity, saying that it must be done. Extraordinary is also a term of normativity, saying that it could be done. It could also be licitly foregone or withdrawn. Now, how we distinguish those is a matter of actually considerable complexity in some cases. I don't think it's actually complex in the Charlie Gard case, but in general, what an ordinary treatment is one that's effective, medically speaking, and doesn't provide a large burden or substantial burden on the patient, morally required treatment. Extraordinary treatment is one that could reasonably be considered too burdensome on the patient relative to the benefit and could be done or might not be done.
So the former is always ethically required and the latter is ethically optional or at least open to debate in a particular case?
That's right. Optional is probably the way to talk about it. Some people have mistaken it for you shouldn't do extraordinary treatment or something like that. That's just false, at least according to the way most people think about the distinction.
Now, it's been said that the experimental treatment that was proposed for Charlie Gard would have constituted extraordinary care. For instance, the June 29th statement issued by the Pontifical Academy for Life seemed to take that position and then seemed to suggest that the British state was right to disallow the treatment, if I'm reading that statement right. So, Charlie, would you say that the experimental treatment proposed for Charlie Gard would have constituted extraordinary care?
Extraordinary in the sense of being up to the parents to decide whether this is something they could pursue or not pursue, yes. Not extraordinary in the sense that I think you may have in mind, or at least the statement may have had in mind, of it being somehow wrong for the treatment to be done, or, you know, obviously disproportionate with any benefit or something like that.
So the arguable disproportion would have had to do with maybe the financial burden of that treatment. And I know some people speculated that it would have been an extraordinary physical burden on Charlie. I'm not totally clear why that should have been the case, but...
Yeah, especially if deep sedation is an option for Charlie. It's tough for me to see how a burden on Charlie could be, at least in the traditional sense, a burden on Charlie could be the reason. But I do think there are legitimate, and I wrote a book on this topic, there are legitimate questions to ask. If you're going to spend £1.3 million to do something like this, might that make it extraordinary all by itself? I think that's a complicated question, but one that the tradition especially asks us to ask.
It's probably useful to specify in this case that the funds were all raised privately, right?
Sure.
So no one was asking the NHS to foot the bill.
That's
on
right.
This one.
That's right. So there's multiple ways to think about how just allocation of resources might factor into the ordinary extraordinary distinction. One obvious way would be is if the funds are directly coming from the state's understanding, funding of their healthcare system as the NHS does. That's a no-brainer. This was, of course, not happening in the Charlie Gard case because the funds were raised privately. However, I think the question still stands. It stands in a different way, but I think it still stands.
There was also the question of the probability of success for this treatment, right? And a bunch of experts lined up to say, well, this is almost certainly not going to help him, this and that. Of course, there were some experts who said, well, there's a good chance it might. I mean, the fact is it was experimental, so we don't know until we try, right?
That's right.
And if it had helped him, then presumably it would have helped more children than just Charlie. But now we don't know because we didn't try.
That's one of the many things that makes the Charlie Gard case so complex and so frankly interesting as a bioethicist, is how do we factor in the good of future generations that might be impacted by this kind of treatment? How do we factor in doctors saying very different things about the likelihood of success? The doctor from right here in New York said it was between an 11 and 57% chance, I think, of there being some improvement in brain function, and smaller chance, but a substantial chance of, I think it was 10% for muscle improvement. That's not nothing, that is something. And going back to the point I made earlier about allocation of resources, if it's £1.3 million for something that has virtually no chance of working, that seems to be obviously disproportionate. If it's £1.3 million for something that has a 10% chance, 40% chance, now you can see why these things get really complex really quickly.
Now, it was also often said that Charlie's ventilator constituted extraordinary care. What's the reasoning there, and what's your take on that?
Extraordinary care always needs a context. There's no way you can just say all ventilators are always extraordinary care or something like that. I can imagine different situations where they would be ordinary or extraordinary. In the case of Charlie Gard, the ventilator was working exactly as it was supposed to be working. Charlie was, as they say in the NICUs, pink and plump and growing. His oxygen was getting where it needed to go. He was functioning as large, especially a few months ago, he was functioning basically as a sick but otherwise normal child. Was there a lot of burden on Charlie as a result of the ventilator? Not as a result of the ventilator. I mean, I think some people maybe accidentally confuse burden of the ventilator versus burden of the life that is being sustained by the ventilator. The former is a perfectly legitimate thing to take into consideration. If Charlie, for instance, had cancer of the throat or something, and it was really painful for him to have a ventilator inside, or if there was something else that was burdensome about the treatment itself, that is something absolutely worth taking into consideration. If it's Charlie's life is not worth living, that is not about the burden of the treatment. And of course, the ordinary extraordinary distinction is about treatment, not about lives. So in the case of Charlie Gard, the treatment was doing exactly what it was supposed to do, and the burden was not very much, if at all. And again, deep sedation could have been used if people were in fact worried about the burden.
So one other distinction that I've seen come up in discussions of Charlie Gard is a distinction between so-called killing and letting die. Is that, to your mind, a valid distinction, or is it pertinent here?
Yeah, it gets in some ways very much connected to the ordinary extraordinary distinction. For the Catholic Church over the last six centuries, we have said, in fact, that choosing how to live a certain way, foreseeing but not intending that death is likely the result of that in the near term, is not euthanasia. It's not euthanasia. And that's frankly what some people have said about the Charlie Gard case and removal of the ventilator, saying, hey, we're not aiming at his death. He's already dying. We're just, you know, letting him die or something like this. But if Charlie's quality of life was much higher, if he were walking around, for instance, with an artificial heart, say, instead of a ventilator, and we remove the artificial heart, and somebody said, well, he's got this terminal diagnosis, he's probably going to die in the next 10 to 15 years, we would never accept that as legitimate. We'd say, no, what's actually going on here is killing by omission. You're removing treatment of, in this case, an artificial heart. In the case of Charlie, it's not clear how long he would have lived. It's a very extremely rare, I think Bambino Hospital called it an ultra rare disease. We know very little about it. So we don't know, in fact, how long Charlie has to live. He's certainly not dying in the end stage process of dying right now. And so that's very important, I think, to drive home, is that when it's a choice that doesn't involve aiming at death, the tradition is very, very open to that if the treatment has a lot of burden associated with it. But Charlie is not imminently dying right now, or he wasn't. I think that's an important point to drive home.
The Anscombe Bioethics Center said in its statement that the decision to terminate Charlie's mechanical ventilation was one that the parents could reasonably have made themselves. Do you think that is the case, or did the parents have a duty to continue ventilation?
I think I want to make a distinction before I answer that. And one distinction would be between what the law should be in a typical Western culture that tries to make room for different understandings of the good, and my own private judgment about that particular case. For the first consideration, I would say absolutely the parents should be the ones making the decision about whether this is ordinary and extraordinary treatment. We don't know all the factors that they know that are being taken into consideration. They know Charlie better than anyone. So as a matter of policy, I think it's very good that we have parents making that call. On the second level, a normative level as opposed to a policy level, I think if any parent makes a decision to remove life-sustaining treatment based on the quality of life of their child, that's problematic. But there's a reason why the Anscombe Center invoked the tradition here on letting parents decide. It's because they're the ones, again, who belong to their child and the child to them. They're the ones that know the child best. They're the ones that have access to all the information and have their version of the good ready to go to make that kind of distinction in ways that you and I, and certainly Judge Francis and others involved, you know, were in no position to make.
So it seems like a wise and just person would be very reluctant to render any moral censure of a parent who makes a decision one way or the other in cases like this, because, I mean, these issues are very complicated at the abstract level, much less at the
Absolutely.
Level of particular cases.
Yeah, especially when you factor in the emotional piece to this. If we're talking about actual moral culpability, which is different than the normative claim in the abstract, boy, you know, I don't know how we get anybody judging Charlie's parents or any other set of parents in these circumstances.
We can judge the state, though.
Yes, we can.
I'm all about that. And what seems to have been the case here is that the doctors in state wanted to remove Charlie's ventilator, not because it was too burdensome or delivering no benefit to Charlie. In fact, it was working by their lights all too well. It was supporting the life of a person who they thought was better off dead. So the burden here, as you've said, was not the treatment, but the life itself. That is horrifying and leads us to a third term that we need to define, which is euthanasia. So, Charlie, what is euthanasia?
Euthanasia is an act or omission which of itself or by intention causes death. And in current discussions of euthanasia, which are almost always related to active, what's sometimes called active euthanasia, we focus more on actions rather than omissions. But interestingly, a lot of different kinds of people from way across the spectrum on ethics agree that there really isn't much of a difference, if any, between aiming at someone's death by action and aiming at someone's death by omission. And it seems very clear to me, and I've taken some heat for offering this position as strongly as I have publicly, but it seems very obvious to me that the people you just mentioned were aiming at Charlie's death by omission. And that's euthanasia.
And so how do we know that? I mean, partly because of the way in which they talked about him, right? And his so-called best interests. So the judge in his case was quoted as saying that Charlie's present quality of life is one that is not worth sustaining. A physician in the case opined that Charlie would receive no benefit from continued life. So in other words, Charlie's life is not worth living. And as far as we can tell, what was it about Charlie's life specifically that caused the state and the doctors to construe it as a burden or a harm?
Well, let me say, I mean, charitably, I think there's a lot of confusion. A lot of this documents that I read, there's a lot of confusion about what precisely is in fact being said, what the reasoning in fact is. But many times the reasoning of the physicians, of the judge, came back to, would the nucleotide therapy be able to help the brain heal itself and restore brain function? Charlie's functioning as a member of the species Homo sapiens was, again, pink, plump, and growing. The focus on the brain was a telling one, in my opinion. Once it was determined that even nucleotide therapy would not help Charlie's brain heal itself, you know, that's when this kind of language that you just mentioned started coming up. His life is not a benefit to him. Let's just call a spade a spade. They thought Charlie was better off dead.
So having defined Charlie's life as a burden or a harm, the British state determined that by trying to keep him alive, Charlie's parents were acting against his best interests, and so the state had a right and duty to intervene. At least that's how I read it. Now, many commentators, perhaps especially Americans, have objected to that intervention as a violation of parents' rights. And then others have responded that the framework of parents' rights is kind of too American a framework, and it's misapplied to a British case. So what does Catholic moral teaching say about this? How far does the legitimate authority of parents over their children extend in a case like this?
Well, first of all, there is something called child abuse. And in point of fact, if a Jehovah's Witness takes their child to a Catholic hospital and says, hey, I want this lung transplant done without blood transfusions because of my religious beliefs, the Catholic hospital is not going to do that. There is this standard that exists. Does this standard even come close to that standard? That's the question, at least in my mind. And it seems obviously not. The idea that this is akin to child abuse, that you feel so strongly that Charlie would be better off dead than alive, is such a strongly held view that you're willing to take it out of the parents' hands. That just boggles my mind. It's one thing to have the view. It's another thing to have the view so strongly and intensely that one is willing to override the views of parents who clearly had the best interests of their child in mind, right? Very clearly. So that's extraordinary in my view.
Now, the British state and the EU obviously regard doctors as best qualified to judge whether a child such as Charlie should live or die. What are the problems with a policy of doctor knows best?
Well, doctor may know best when it comes to medical data, though I think doctor error, or at least medical error, is the third leading cause of death in the United States, so maybe not in every circumstance, even with regard to medical data. What doctors are definitely not knowing best about these days is whether or not someone's life is worth living. I mean, you can access study after study which shows something that's not surprising if you think about it. A privileged physician is going to have a lower estimate of a quality of life of a patient that is not as privileged, maybe a disabled patient or something like that. Makes perfect sense. We've been using this kind of concern for the vulnerable versus concern for the privileged thing in ethics for two decades now. It's very interesting. It hasn't reached very strongly into this area of public policy, though, and decision making. And in fact, the crowd that would normally speak up in favor of disabled lives in other contexts was silent, as far as I could tell, in the debate over Charlie Gard.
Why do you think that was?
I think it's in part because the debate very early on, because of the participants, was framed and narrated as kind of like a pro-life versus a not pro-life debate. And in the United Kingdom, interestingly, the United Kingdom tried to legalize assisted suicide a couple years ago, and it failed dramatically. And it was led by, as it's been led here, the opposition was led by their physicians and churches and advocates for the disabled, disability groups. When it's been defeated here, as in many blue states, assisted suicide has been defeated. It's also been led by that coalition of physicians, religious people, and disabled. Now, why this wouldn't take place in the Charlie Gard case, again, I think is because the frankly, abortion politics kind of reared their ugly heads again, and we weren't able to create that coalition. But in the euthanasia debate more generally, where the abortion politics are there, but not as maybe dramatically pronounced, that the disability groups come in and make their case quite powerfully.
Charlie, tell us about the Journal of Medical Ethics Infanticide Symposium of 2013.
Yeah, at least in my world, this was a moment where a respected, arguably the first or second ranked journal in all the bioethics academic world had a symposium, which I think they titled Abortion, Infanticide, and Allowing Children to Die 40 Years On. Because it was about 40 years ago that the first rumblings of pro-choice views for infanticide started to come about, Michael Tooley, Peter Singer, and others. Interestingly, the editor of the Journal of Medical Ethics is Peter Singer's student, Julian Savulescu, who came out in favor of the parents. He's now an Oxford professor of ethics and medicine.
So in the Charlie Gard case.
In the Charlie Gard case, he came out in favor of the parents. And he made an interesting point. He said, listen, if what's actually going on here is a judgment that Charlie's life is no longer a benefit to him, why aren't these people pushing to overturn the United Kingdom's laws against direct euthanasia? Wouldn't it be better, in fact, to just give Charlie an overdose of some kind of pain medication and let him drift off rather than, you know, extubate him and let him essentially suffocate, right? The connection is seen very perfectly in Catholic moral theology, but it's also seen in the Julian Savulescu and Peter Singer crowd as well. And this is the argument that many people in the 2013 edition of the Journal of Medical Ethics made. They said, hey, listen, you guys who are all up in arms about us arguing for infanticide, we already do this. We already do this every day in hospitals all over the country in the United Kingdom. We aim at people's death by omission. Wouldn't it be better? Doesn't it make sense that we would just do it by action? This already happens in the Netherlands. There's something called the Groningen Protocol in the Netherlands, which is explicitly for giving newborns direct euthanasia. And there's the logic, it seems, is impeccable. Why wouldn't we move this? So this is why I think it's so important to stand up and be heard at this cultural moment when we're debating over Charlie Gard and say, let's be very careful about the arguments we're using. One can, of course, be licitly in support of one or another position here, but let's be very careful that what we're not doing is saying that it's time for Charlie to die. One thing this case has shown all of us is that we need to really, really reason more tightly and carefully about the ethics and not just rely on the received anthropological wisdom of whatever physicians that happen to be an authority intuit. We need to put our values right out there and have them withstand scrutiny and apply the views consistently across cases and be willing to defend them when they're challenged. And that's not what's being done. It's just kind of a free-for-all of, well, this physician thinks that it's not in Charlie's interest, the judge accepts that, and we're off and running. But again, there's not really a question mooted about what is the anthropology, what is moral status, what is a life worth living. These questions aren't really being systematically asked and answered and challenged.
On July 18th, 1817, Jane Austen died at age 41. The nature of her fatal illness is unclear, though her recorded symptoms suggest Hodgkin's lymphoma. As early as 1813, around the publication of Pride and Prejudice, Austen had suffered from back pain, pruritus, neuralgia, night fevers, and anemia causing weakness and discoloration of the face. Meanwhile, she composed another masterpiece or three. She seems to have been dying in plain sight, though almost invisibly. Her niece Caroline later wrote, "Aunt Jane's health began to fail before we knew she was really ill." In Austen's novels, death is both inevitable and a surprise. Her characters deny or overlook mortality out of fear of it or out of hatred of one another. What I've just said is contrary to the rap on Austen's novels, which is still around, bafflingly to me, that they are the drawing room sketches of our spinster Aunt Jane, all etiquette and crumpets. Tis the season for Jane Austen hot takes, so here's mine. Et in Arcadia Ego. In this 200th anniversary summer of her death, I'd like to dwell on sin and death in Austen land. Austen's best novel, for my money, is Emma, published in 1815. Emma is also her most seemingly idyllic. Unlike all other Austen novels, Emma stays in one place, the rural village of Highbury. Its heroine, 20-year-old Emma Woodhouse, presides over a little rustic hierarchy. Handsome, clever, and rich, as in the novel's famous incipit, Emma has everything she needs in Highbury. She has no need to jaunt to London, just 16 miles away, and she has never seen the sea. In Chapter 10, she boasts of her independent resources and declares that she will never marry.
Fortune I do not want. Employment I do not want. Consequence I do not want. I believe few married women are half as much mistress of their husband's house as I am of Hartfield.
Two paradises 'twere in one, to live in paradise alone. But evil is present in Highbury, and not just in the form of Frank Churchill, the Frenchified interloper. Evil is part of the indigenous social structure. Take this comment on the village spinster, the good-natured Miss Bates. We're told that she enjoyed a most uncommon degree of popularity
for a woman neither young, handsome, rich, nor married. Miss Bates stood in the very worst predicament in the world for having much of the public favour, and she had no intellectual superiority to make atonement to herself or frighten those who might hate her into outward respect.
D.W. Harding notices this passage in Regulated Hatred, his important essay on Austen, which appeared in F.R. Leavis's Scrutiny in 1940. Harding argues that we need to take that verb, hate, very seriously. He knows that most of us unconsciously delete it or replace it with some euphemism, frighten those who might scorn her, frighten those who might look down on her. Our revisions preserve the politeness of our spinster Aunt Jane. They also save us from indictment. Read the words Austen wrote and we learn, a lot of people in polite society are haters. Their hatred is just barely regulated, if we're lucky, by fear or by social convention. Harding was a war psychologist with a gloomy outlook. He thought that people were stupid, evil, a danger to each other. His reading of Austen deposed our gentle Aunt Jane and installed a spinster with a vendetta. It's hard not to notice in this connection that Austen, when writing Emma, was herself a woman neither young, handsome, rich, nor married. Harding's Austen may seem to be more about the hatred than the regulation, but I think Harding is right about Austen's fierce moral indictments, about her hatred of stupidity and evil. I think this especially when I watch bad film adaptations. Please, please don't show me, as some movies will, pillow talk between Mr. Bennet of Pride and Prejudice and his detestable wife, whom, he confesses obliquely near the end of the novel, he degraded himself by marrying. Harding is right as well that the regulation of evil, not its eradication, is Austen's goal. I've always enjoyed Mr. Darcy's line,
"Where there is a real superiority of mind, pride will always be under good regulation."
Austen writes, Elizabeth turned away to hide a smile. Well, she might. Darcy is proud to say that he's so smart his pride regulates itself. The insight is ironized by its messenger, but it is true. We have our vices, and the trick is to keep them under good regulation. Likewise, in a virtuous society, hatred will always be under good regulation. To the extent that that expression sounds oxymoronic, it crystallizes how far the virtuous society is from actual perfection, which is to say, it acknowledges the fall. Christian morals in a temperate English version is how the critic Graham Huff characterized Austen's moral code. The exemplar is Emma's eventual match, Mr. George Knightley. Guys, look at his name. George, after the patron saint of England. Knightley, for the militant Christianity embodied by the medieval slayer of dragons, rendered temperate in the early 19th century gentry. Mr. Knightley is a domesticated knight, very much at home at Donwell Abbey, his ancestral estate outside Highbury. He is a knight inerrant in both senses of that word. He does not err, and he does not wander abroad seeking battles. Soberly and eloquently, he seeks to regulate evil at home. He rescues a damsel when he must. On the dance floor, he rescues Harriet Smith from her humiliation by the status-seeking clergyman, Mr. Elton. On Box Hill, he rescues Miss Bates from Emma's cruelty, and Emma from her own moral idiocy. It's a famous episode. The ranking Hibernians have gathered for a picnic, and they begin a game of saying each one clever thing or three dull ones. The spinster Miss Bates, a great talker upon little matters, full of trivial communications and harmless gossip, who tends to get on Emma's nerves, happily predicts that she'll have no trouble saying dull things. Emma replies with nasty humor that her challenge will be to limit herself to three. Ouch. Emma seems to assume that Miss Bates didn't get this joke, because poor spinsters don't get jokes or something. Once the picnic has broken up, Mr. Knightley catches up with Emma for one of the most morally devastating encounters in literature.
Emma, how could you be so unfeeling to Miss Bates? How could you be so insolent to a woman of her age and situation? I'd not thought it possible.
How could I help saying it? I dare say she did not understand me.
I assure you she felt your full meaning. She cannot stop mentioning it. I wish you could have heard her honor your forbearance in putting up with her when her society is so irksome.
I know there is no better creature in all the world, but you must allow that blended alongside the good, there is an equal amount of the ridiculous in her.
Were she prosperous or a woman equal to you in situation, I would not quarrel about any liberties of manner. But she is poor. Even more so than when she was born. And should she live to be an old lady, she will sink further still. Her situation being in every way below you should secure your compassion. Badly done, Emma. Badly done.
You can't see it because this is a podcast, but Gwyneth Paltrow as Emma is dissolving in tears. Knightley's censure of Emma is devastating, in part because it is temperate. And its temperance is both moral and rhetorical. Knightley's words are just, fair, and they are le mot juste, precise. The Christian moralist, temperate English version, has a code, consistent but not rigid, flexible but not ad hoc, stringent but not fanatical. It is chivalric and articulate, and regulates the hatred of the lofty for the low. And it indicts us as the party of haters to whom Miss Bates is ridiculous. Her conversation has been full of apple dumplings and the rivets of broken spectacles and kitchen chimneys and asparagus and soup.
My dear Miss Woodhouse, I come quite overpowered. Such a beautiful hindquarter of pork. You are too bountiful. Have you heard the news?
It was before tea.
Mr. Elton is going to be married.
It could not be before tea because we were just going to cards. And yet it was before tea because I remember thinking,
just ready to come out.
No. I was only gone down to speak to Patty again about the pork. Jane was standing in the passage.
Were you not with
such society as Highbury? I always say we are quite blessed in our neighbours.
My mother was so afraid that we had not any salting pan large enough, so I said I would go down and see, and Jane said, shall I go down instead, for I think you have a little cold, and Patty has been washing the kitchen.
27 years, and now poor old man. He is bedridden and very poorly with the rheumatic gout in his joints.
If there is one thing my mother loves better than another, it is pork. A roast loin of pork.
Yeah, nobody needs that. But implicit in Miss Bates's dialogue is a polemic about epistemology, about what we think is worth noticing and what we overlook. Miss Bates stands in a line from Mistress Quickly to Pamela to Molly Bloom, of literary women with logorrhea, these ladies with their fixations on domestic minutiae. arguably imparted to the novel its domestic focus. They are also often read as a feminine challenge to conventional hierarchies of significance. But Miss Bates's femininity seems less pertinent in this instance than her socioeconomic status. The Bates household is poor and getting poorer. The need for economy reinforces Miss Bates's affinity with trivia. Her chatter is full of attention to small things, often gifts and favors from wealthy friends on whose charity she depends. The beautiful hindquarter of pork you sent us. Emma Woodhouse, the First Lady of Highbury, is not accustomed to dwelling on how beautiful the hindquarter of pork, how sufficient for the maintenance of a modest style of life. Emma can condescend to tolerate the discourse of a ridiculous spinster. She does not take interest in it. And as Miss Bates's life is unlived by Emma, so her discourse should be unheard. On Box Hill, Emma acts as though Miss Bates did not quite speak or understand English, as though she were not quite sentient. There's a scene in David Copperfield that airs the same moral idiocy more grotesquely. Steerforth expresses the stupid opinion that the poor are less sensitive than the upper classes. They are not easily wounded. His interlocutor follows up sarcastically, "It's such a delight to know that when they suffer, they don't feel. Sometimes I have been quite uneasy for that sort of people, but now I shall just dismiss the idea of them altogether." Austen and Dickens, in their different registers, show us the evil of choosing not to know the suffering of others. Emma does not know Miss Bates's privation and humiliation, the unprovided, unattended life she leads, consequent to her spinsterism, which is a biological and social failure very different from Emma's lofty resolution on celibacy. Emma has said explicitly that it's not spinsters who are detestable, it's just poor spinsters.
A single woman with a very narrow income must be a ridiculous, disagreeable old maid, the proper sport of boys and girls. But a single woman of good fortune is always respectable and may be as sensible and pleasant as anybody else. For a very narrow income has a tendency to contract the mind and sour the temper. Those who can barely live and who live perforce in a very small and generally very inferior society may well be illiberal and cross. This does not apply, however, to Miss Bates,
who, instead of being narrow and cross, is so silly, so smiling, so prosing, so undistinguishing and unfastidious, and so apt to tell everything that runs through her head. Narrow or prosing, Miss Bates is a member of the class poor spinster, a ridiculous old maid. Her interiority is not a locus of significance. Possibly she has no interiority, only superabundant exteriority in the form of chatter. She is the proper sport of boys and girls, in part because no one who is ridiculous can catch irony or feel pain. They are not easily wounded. Does Emma hate Miss Bates? She would never say so. But Box Hill reveals that the poor spinster lacks the intellectual superiority to frighten rich young women into outward respect. If Emma does not hate Miss Bates, it is only because she judges her not worth hating. There's something spooky about the Bates household. I've always been struck by Miss Bates's warning to her visitors, "Ours is rather a dark staircase." This is an apology for her poverty. Windows are expensive, as are candles. It's also an expression of Miss Bates's sense that the world is full of peril. Watch your step. She knows what hazards may befall you on your way up, or especially down. There's a lot of fear in this novel, fear of change above all. Miss Bates's socioeconomic status has changed for the worse, and she fears further decline. But the rich characters have fears, too. The novel's opening chapter is full of dread. Emma's governess got married this morning, and now...
The wedding over, and the bride people gone, her father and herself were left to dine together, with no prospect of a third to cheer a long evening. Her father composed himself to sleep after dinner, as usual, and she had then only to sit and think of what she had lost. It was a melancholy change, and Emma could not but sigh over it and wish for impossible things till her father awoke and made it necessary to be cheerful. He was a nervous man, easily depressed, fond of everybody that he was used to and hating to part with them, hating change of every kind. Matrimony, as the origin of change, was always disagreeable.
Emma shares with her father an intuition that all change is fatal. Deaths break up households. So do marriages. Of course Emma does not want to marry. She says later, "I cannot really change for the better. Best to remain the virgin daughter, immured in an unvarying household, a Regency Miss Havisham." Emma's father, Mr. Woodhouse, is another character who hyper-focuses on trivia, whereas Miss Bates's anxieties are produced by disorder in the body politic, Mr. Woodhouse's concern bodily disorder. Pardon my diagnoses, but Mr. Woodhouse is a morbid, agoraphobic, anorexic hypochondriac. He rarely walks outside. He fears the dews of a summer evening. He almost gives up the ghost when he has to ride in a coach while snow is falling. He fears open doors. He idolizes, nay, fetishizes, his apothecary. He considers wedding cake unwholesome and tries to prevent people from eating it. Speaking of parallels with Miss Havisham, he regrets that when he hosts people for dinner, he has to inflict food on them. He advises a small apple tart, a small half glass of wine, and no custard. For himself, he is forever seeking the perfect consistency of gruel, smooth and thin, but not too thin. Like Mrs. Bennet of Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Woodhouse is a hypochondriac and a parent who knows one thing exclusively and fanatically. Mrs. Bennet knows that daughters must have husbands. Mr. Woodhouse knows that death comes for all. Mrs. Bennet's hypochondria is not thematically related to her one insight. It's an aspect of her unseriousness, and it's played for laughs.
"You must tell him what a dreadful state I'm in. How I have such tremblings and flutterings all over me. Such spasms in my side and pains in my head and beatings at my heart that I can get no rest either night or day. And tell Lydia not to give any directions about wedding clothes till she has seen me, for she does not know which are the best warehouses."
By contrast, Mr. Woodhouse's hypochondria, all his little pathologies, are unsettling. Unlike Mrs. Bennet, he is tender in his obsessionality, and he elicits tenderness in others. He knows about death in a paradoxical way. He tries to unknow it by stopping the clocks, ceasing to metabolize. We all seek a perfect consistency of gruel, or a perfect probiotic yogurt culture, or a perfect exercise regimen. We all give death the tribute of denial, because, like Mr. Woodhouse, we fear it for our own sake and others. Or some of us deny it because we're haters. Near the end of the novel, death comes for Mrs. Churchill. She's the aunt and foster mother of Frank Churchill, a wealthy woman with power over Frank and his connections. We never meet her, but she is talked about and hated on constantly. We hear that she is ill-humored, odd-tempered, and capricious, that life in her household must be dreadful. She has long claimed to be ill, dying even, with some undisclosed illness. Its recurrences supply occasions for her recalling Frank to her side and otherwise jerking him around. Nobody believes that she is dying. As to her illness, all nothing, of course. Then she up and dies. We can adapt Caroline's comment on her Aunt Jane. "Mrs. Churchill's health began to fail before we knew she was really ill." We assume that hypochondriacs will never die, ditto the women we hate. Yet Mrs. Churchill said she was dying in plain English, much as Austin was dying in plain sight. Austin was a spinster of slender means rather than a powerful married lady. The chiming of their two deaths, heralded yet unanticipated, points up the way of all flesh. Austin's brother Henry wrote in 1817, "Her decline was at first deceitfully slow, and until the spring of this present year, those who knew their happiness to be involved in her existence could not endure to despair." concealed by hatred or by fear and love. Even in Austin land, there am I. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my guest, Charlie Camozzi. Thanks to the BBC and Miramax for audio clips from their fine adaptations of Pride and Prejudice and Emma, all covered by fair use. Thanks likewise to Alison Larkin's charming audiobook. And thank you, listeners.